Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. I'm Dr. Marty Gentius of Kent State University, and this week on Counselor Audio Source, contributing editor Laura Bruneau speaks with Dr. Paula Britton of John Carroll University about working with clients afflicted with HIV/AIDS.
All right, we'd like to welcome Dr. Paula Britton to Counselor Audio Source, and we're going to be talking about working with clients who have HIV and or AIDS today. So Paula, I was hoping that what you could first do is tell me what the difference is between having AIDS and having HIV.
Okay. Well, first of all, having HIV means that you have the virus in your system. So that means if you had an HIV test, you would test positive for the virus. This does not mean that you have AIDS.
Okay.
AIDS, what sometimes is referred to as full-blown AIDS, comes if you're, meet certain criteria. Those criteria change over the years. However, generally you have you come down with one of the major illnesses that people with AIDS are known, like pneumocystis pneumonia. Mm-hmm. It also means that your T cell count is below 200. Okay, so that means that your T cell counts are your good cells, they're helper cells. So if they become too low, your immune system is compromised and you're more likely to get one of the major illnesses associated with AIDS.
Okay. So from what I've heard, most people don't die actually from AIDS. They die from another disease.
Right. AIDS, they might die from one of the diseases that's associated mm-hmm. with AIDS, right?
Okay.
But the AIDS itself is a term referring to your immune system being compromised to such an extent that your body can be taken over by other illnesses.
And then does it vary for people how long they might have HIV?
It varies. And some people have HIV and never convert to AIDS, and we don't really know exactly why. There are certain variables associated with that, and there are some people that convert rather quickly, meaning they get exposed to HIV, and then with a year or two, they might be full-blown AIDS.
Okay.
We do know certain things such as drug use, drug history, your overall health, your age. Those kinds of things play a variable in how sick people mm-hmm. get, how soon people get sick, but mostly it's kind of a question that we don't have the answer to.
Okay. So you can't very well predict.
You cannot predict. Mm-hmm. And there are certain things you can try to help predict, but overall, they'll take your T cell count and they'll take your viral load. And as your viral load increases, your greater chance of getting full-blown AIDS.
Okay. So are there certain medications that can help mm-hmm. for a person who, let's say, has HIV, is HIV positive or who has AIDS?
Yes. In fact, there's been quite a lot of work being done in this area of medication.
Mm-hmm.
And it's transformed the disease to people thinking of it instead of a terminal illness as kind of a lifelong, like diabetes mm-hmm. or
like
chronic illness,
mm-hmm.
correct. But the medication is called HART, Highly Aggressive Antiretroviral Therapy, which includes a class of drugs called protease inhibitors, which are taken in combination with other more familiar antiviral drugs such as AZT or 3TC. So you'll hear these terms. I know it's a lot of medical terms, but you may hear the word drug cocktail mm-hmm. or three-drug therapy. More and more, however, we're getting down to, used to be that people have to take 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 pills a day. And the progress is also in that area, and that now there are less pills that people have to take. However, there's really horrible side effects to these medications.
What kinds of side effects are common?
Nausea, fatigue. Some of them are creating this hump on the back of your... It almost looks like you have osteoporosis. It's very disfiguring. People get very sick. The other thing that happens after they're on these drugs a while, they develop a resistance. So they may work for a couple years, but then all of a sudden your viral load starts to creep up and you have to give a different medication. Once you change a medication, then the side effects change, and it's very rigorous on people. The other problem with these medications that is if you stop taking them for any reason, such as you're going to Europe and you don't want to be sick for a week, HIV virus is very smart. And so once you stop taking the medication, the virus will mutate. And so then when you begin to take the medication again, they won't work. Once these medications don't work, they'll never work again. This has huge implications in terms of mental health, because if you have people who are homeless, who it's schizophrenic, people who are MR, people using heavy drugs, they're probably not going to take these medications every day.
Mm-hmm. So the virus is going to continue to mutate?
The virus will continue to mutate, and then if you give someone else your virus, the person who gets your virus will also have a drug-resistant form of AIDS. So it's kind of a scary thing. It creates a lot of ethical issues for people in that, do you give these medications to people you think won't be compliant? But if you don't, they could die. So there's a lot of ethical, moral issues around the treatment, the medical treatment for people.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that can become a counseling issue, because it really, people really need to look at how they can behaviorally make changes that will be conducive to staying on their medication.
And that's something that counselors should very well be aware of, that
yes.
if they do stop taking their drug cocktails, then it could have some very possible huge side effects.
Huge, right, exactly.
Okay. All right. So how prevalent is AIDS right now in the United States?
It's hard to really have to get a handle on the numbers, because we don't have mandatory reporting for HIV. Some states don't have any reporting for it. Some states do. So our numbers are really hard to know. I think they're right now, the latest figure I saw was right now approximately 40,000 people a year are being infected. And around 100,000 people have 900,000 people have full-blown AIDS in this country. But my guess is the numbers are much higher mm-hmm. than what's being reported.
Mm-hmm. Which would make sense.
Yeah.
Okay. So are there certain demographic groups that AIDS is more prevalent in terms of the United States?
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of the United States, we're seeing among African American and Latino groups of people, it's very high. It's still higher among homosexual population, gay men. One of the largest groups right now that's gaining, that AIDS is gaining numbers in, is women, particularly women of color. That is the highest numbers rising in that group. The other big group we're seeing is back to gay men again, and particularly around crystal meth and some of the party drugs that are being used are highly related to increased HIV numbers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you mentioned earlier that AIDS is very similar to having another chronic illness.
Mm-hmm.
But are there any unique issues for AIDS or HIV positive?
Yes.
As opposed to something, let's say,
yes,
cancer.
Yes, I think there are unique issues. There's certainly some similarities, particularly to cancer or some other progressive illnesses. But the first one is kind of this unpredictability. Like with cancer, usually you have some idea what stage you're in, what kind of you can expect, what the chances are of you getting better, et cetera. Although not completely foolproof, there is some of that information for people. With HIV, you absolutely cannot predict how the course of the illness will surface for you. So you can be feeling great one day, and then 2 weeks later, very, very sick. So you start to make changes around being sick, such as moving home or quitting your job or selling your insurance policies, etc. And then 2 months later, you're feeling great again. So you've made all these changes, but now you're ready to go back to work, or you feel ready to live independently, so it makes it very difficult for people to predict how this is going to come out for them. Another thing that I think is different is the stigma. Mm-hmm. Although there is stigma with other diseases such as cancer, the stigma around HIV/AIDS is really about the behaviors that are associated with how one might get HIV, such as sex and use of drugs, and those topics tend to be highly stigmatized in this country, as well as others. It's also what we call developmentally incongruent. What this means is that it's hitting younger people, although older people are getting HIV at a pretty alarming rate. Overall, it's been a young disease. And so the issues that people, psychosocial issues people have to deal with in their 20s, are typically not ones around, you know, preparing to die or preparing to look at your life in the way that maybe an 80-year-old might be doing. So it doesn't fit with their life stage. in your 20s, typically people are thinking about individuating, about their career, about their families, about developing significant relationships, and that's not what people with HIV/AIDS are being asked to do.
Mm-hmm. I think one other thing I read is that it can be very isolating.
Yes, thank you. It can be extremely isolating. I think this is getting a bit better, but in the beginning stages of this disease, people were ostracized in restaurants. People in hospitals felt like they were, you know, put in separate rooms with gowns, and people were afraid to touch them. It also has a lot of impact on their sexuality as people. What does it mean for me as a person to be sexual if I have this disease, that I can give this disease to someone else? Mm-hmm.
So and even just their general support system, for example, if their parents don't approve of maybe the fact that they contracted this because they were a drug user or things like that, I can just see how maybe even their own social network might break away.
Right. And, you know, I've seen a lot of cases where people, cause of death was something other than HIV/AIDS, even though they did die of HIV/AIDS because the family was so embarrassed or didn't want people to know. So there is that feeling, again, of stigma and isolation and being really alone and being a bad boy or girl kind of thing that can be huge for people.
Is there a higher rate of suicide for people who have who are HIV positive?
There is a higher rate of suicide, although we may get into this topic a little more. There's what's called rational suicide, which looks a little bit different from the kind of suicide I think we think about where people are depressed and just decide to take their life. A lot of people with this disease, at some point in the process of their counseling or their therapy, spend some time really thinking about when it might be time for them to end their life and what that would look like and why they want to do that. For example, someone might say, by the time if I lose my sight or if I lose my mental capacities at that point, I'd rather take my life than go through the pain and suffering and have my family go through the cost, etc. So that's a little bit different from the other kind of suicide that you might see as a result of a crisis or of a depression.
Which might be a rash decision, for
example.
Correct.
And we do see that as well. That typically comes at a different point. So, you know, but you do see more of the rational suicide with something like this than you might with other kinds of other kinds of issues.
Okay. Well, let's get a little bit into actually working with clients who might have who might be HIV positive or have AIDS. What role do counselors have with ethical issues such as confidentiality and duty to warn mm-hmm. when you're working with this population?
It's very complicated. I think the major issue people struggle with is what happens if I'm working with a client that has HIV/AIDS and is sexually active or sharing needles with someone else, and does that make me, you know, do I need to report that as a duty to warn? So it gets very complicated, and there's a lot being written on this. And I'd refer students to Jim Werth's work, W-E-R-T-H, out of the University of Akron, to get a more thorough understanding of the process. And that is really imperative that people kind of look at how they might handle these situations before they get in them. But the first thing I'd want to say, if you get yourself in a situation where you're not sure, the best thing to do is, first of all, is to consult with someone who is an expert in this area. But again, in a naive nutshell, what people want to look at is if their client is willing to participate in changing behaviors so that they're going to be safe or their partner's going to be safe or people they're with. And if they're doing that, typically you can work with the client to make those behavioral changes.
So start almost having a dialogue with them.
That's
with
right.
your client about how you can be safe and how you can make sure other people in your life are safe.
Right.
That type of thing.
The only time that I've ever had to think about warning is when a client is telling me that they're not willing to participate in any discussion about changing what they're doing and that there is a person out there who is at risk. One particular example was a couple I worked with, and she did not know he was infected. And he was infected, and he was having unprotected sex with her. And in that circumstance, unless he was willing to change, that would be an example of a time that I'd have to warn.
Okay. And then in terms of confidentiality, it just follows normal procedure. They need to have a release of information for you to be able to disclose any of that, of their illness, let's say, to a third party.
That's correct. It becomes really important because this is, there's so many secrets involved in this disease. But I do think it's also really important that you, at the beginning of working with people with HIV, that you're clear about your exceptions to confidentiality, about this duty to warn, that people know that up front, so that they're prepared to, if they do confide in you, that you, that they've been given due process on what you might do with that information.
Okay. I know that you've written about there's a 4-stage developmental model for working with clients who have HIV. Could you describe for me what those stages are? First of all, the name, the types of issues faced by these clients per stage, and then what are counseling tasks that counselors can attend to during each of these stages?
Okay. This model really is kind of a generic crisis model. You could use this model, for example, with someone who had just been raped or some other kinds of crises. So it's not my model, but what I did was borrow from crisis theory and applied it to the HIV client. Although I'm going to be describing this model as sounding like it's linear, it really is not, and I'll hopefully can come back and kind of explain that. But the first, let me go back and say that this model, again, kind of starts with a person getting an HIV diagnosis. So this is someone who went in and perhaps got tested or was being having their blood test flus or et cetera, and gets the information that they are HIV positive. Again, this does not mean they have AIDS, but this means that the virus is in their system.
So this is something they just found out.
So they just found out, and that can happen obviously many different ways for people. In Ohio, there's in I think in most states now, there is anonymous testing, meaning you can go in and get tested without giving any information about who you are. They'll use a fake name or a fake number. So it's very, you feel very safe with the information. If you go just get confidential testing, like in your doctor's offices, that information is not considered fully confidential. So anyway, that's a side point. But the person, let's say, that just finds out that they're HIV positive, typically will deal with this similar to how they might deal with any other life. And if you think about yourself initially, that's probably how you'll deal with this particular crisis. So some common responses to initial crises is denial, numbness, kind of a feeling like it's not real. Mm-hmm. Some people kind of depersonalize, almost feel like they're out of their body. Often, just like in slow motion. Some people react almost the opposite way with hysteria, almost kind of a breakdown, feeling like they're going to just not be able to survive. If you were a counselor working with someone who's at this stage, what you really want to help them do is to cope. Okay, you want to normalize their response. This is not the time you're going to work through any issue. This is about getting them safe, somewhere to stay, and helping them regulate to a point where they can function. And giving them lots of permission, not necessarily to look at it all right now. For example, going back to the crisis or the rape analogies, it's not the time the client's going to work their rape, or work through it, or work their feelings about it. You're just going to say, let's get you safe, let's get you comfortable, and let's get you in a spot where you can know you can come back and I'll and work with me, and I'll stay with you in this journey. Oftentimes, people are given a lot of information. And so, again, another analogy would be you go to the doctor and they tell you you have cancer, and from then on you don't hear anything else. And they give you all sorts of details on, you know, what this cancer is and what it looks like and what it might do to you, and you don't hear any of it. Similarly with HIV, oftentimes people's cognitively, they just numb out. And yet this may be the only time that somebody has access to them to give them some of this information. So it's kind of tricky. We recommend things are put in writing and those kinds of things. But just kind of being cognizant, if you're the counselor, that they may not be taking anything information-wise in, mm-hmm. that they're too dysregulated.
Okay. So a counselor could work with a client at this stage, for example, if they were a counselor at an HIV/AIDS testing center.
Correct.
That would be a prime example where they would have
right.
this. But then also somebody might call an agency in a time of crisis. They might have just discovered that they were diagnosed
That's
with this.
Right.
And then they could come in for a crisis.
That's right. Situation. If you work in a hospital or in any kind of clinic setting where people mm-hmm. might be getting tested for other reasons.
Okay. And I think this time, I mean, obviously it's going to vary from person to person. Everyone
right.
responds to a situation differently. But on average, would you say this lasts a few weeks?
You know, it can last a few weeks. It can last a few years.
Okay.
I've seen people, especially because of the stigma, go into denial, and they hear the information, and they frankly just put it out of their head because they can't take it. If you think about what is the purpose of denial, well, it's a major defense mechanism. It's there to protect you. It's like your psyche says, I can't take this, so I'm not going to. If I let this in, it'll kill me.
Mm-hmm. It'll make it real.
It'll make it real. Mm-hmm. So one of the things, especially early on in the disease, I saw happen a lot was people just said, all right, I'm just going to go on with my life and pretend like I didn't hear that. And then they don't really acknowledge it again until they get their first symptom, whether it's a Kaposi sarcoma on their face or whether they start getting a swollen lymph gland or they start to feel fatigue and they're thinking, oh, my God, here it is. Then they go back into that crisis stage again and get activated until they can kind of figure out a way to get to the next stage, which the next stage is what we call adjustment.
Okay.
And this is where people begin to kind of digest about this information, that it becomes, instead of a dreamlike feel to it, that it starts to become real. And typically at this stage, we see a lot of issues for people around disclosure. You know, who am I going to tell? In the crisis stage, sometimes people don't think about it and they start telling everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're sorry later on. But in this stage, it's kind of like, what is this, you know, what am I going to do with this information? These people can also get very depressed and very anxious when they start to really let it in, that denial breaks down. Their system doesn't really know how to adapt yet to the information. So we'll see a lot of like numbing and then spikes of anxiety, spikes of depression. Suicide risk is high here, higher than actually in the first stage. It's more real and overwhelming. The other thing that people can do at this stage is begin to think about how they're going to be treated medically, making good decisions. The counseling interventions at this stage are supportive. People oftentimes do well in support groups where they can sit with other people who are living with this disease, see how other people are coping, and begin to let it in. It's not really the time to work through deep issues yet. Okay, it's still a time where a therapist would want to help follow the client and help the person make some choices, help the person get stable.
This might be a time when they might start deciding about what medications to take.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. It's also a time where I think some psychotropic medication can be helpful.
Okay.
Such as anti-anxiety or antidepressant treatment, so they can kind of keep their symptoms from being so debilitating that they can function. So many of these people are not sick, okay? So they're going on with their life. They have work, they have families, they have obligations in the world. And in order to function, they have to keep these symptoms managed.
You're talking about mental health symptoms?
Correct.
Okay.
See if there's anything. So I do like the group counseling model, although that's not for everyone. But that gives people models of people who are adapting and models of people who aren't. So they can say, wow, I used to be there and I'm not there anymore. I'm really making some progress. They also can share medical information. They can share myths, et cetera. The third stage is what I call acceptance. And in this stage is really where one begins to form a new sense of equilibrium, kind of like who am I in relationship to this disease? I'm a person. I have HIV, but I also am a person. I have other identities. And so how do I integrate what this means for me? And during this stage, people can do a lot of in-depth work, a lot of family of origin work, a lot of work around their emotions, their feelings, their purpose of life. Spiritual explorations are big here.
Mm-hmm. Imagine a lot of existential
issues. people finding a new way to live, kind of a here and now type living style, as opposed to being so planful and looking at the future. How can I experience each day in a meaningful way, because that's all I really have. And I see people, I've seen over the years, people make tremendous progress in finding a new way to live and a new way to kind of conceptualize the meaning of their life. And some remarkable kinds of things transpire. Not everyone does, and not everyone gets to this stage. Now, let me remind you that at this point, sometimes there's a lot of coming out issues, not just coming out of a person's gay or bisexual or a drug user, but just coming out that they are HIV. So they may have been hiding this from people that they love, and at this stage, they're ready to tell. So let's say a gay male decides to tell his parents not only that he's gay, but that he's HIV. Remember, the parents are going to be, when they first hear this information, they're going to be in the crisis stage. They're going to be reacting with kind of that shock or whatever that the person who has already worked through it has already worked through. So it causes a lot of familial issues because, look, I'm ready, I want to tell you, I want you to accept this, and the their family's still just not there. And sometimes they never get there, but I've seen along the family sometimes need some time to catch up with the person, and that can be an interesting dynamic to work through in therapy. What else do I want to say about? But at this, during this particular time, you also have to pay attention to depression and anxiety. It's a little bit different here because what we know about HIV/AIDS is some of the symptoms of the disease itself can mimic anxiety or it can mimic depression. Mm-hmm. So if a person's slow and lethargic and having trouble with memory, those can be symptoms, physical symptoms of HIV, and they can also be symptoms of depression. So it's sometimes difficult to discern. So it's important to kind of stay on top of your diagnosis.
So sometimes you might be working with someone and you think they're depressed because they're having trouble getting out of bed. They're so tired all the time. So you automatically assume, oh, they must be depressed, when in fact it might be the HIV.
Exactly.
Okay.
And, we're not neurologists, so it's not our area, but that's why it's really important to be able to have a relationship with physicians, and it's, I think, better done in a team setting where people can work together if you're starting to notice things. But typically, from a psychological standpoint, if they don't respond to antidepressants or they respond to behavioral management of their symptoms, then I would refer them for more testing and neurological testing. So HIV does affect the brain and can mimic and is cause dementia and other kind of very severe cognitive symptoms. Another issue here, a huge issue, is employment issues with folks. Again, they may be in this acceptance stage and they're still not sick, or they may be getting sick and they're making choices about what to do around work. Oftentimes when people in that first or second stage, sometimes make decisions rather impulsively, whether to quit a job or to tell everyone at work and get themselves in kind of some trouble economically around their jobs and employment. And then after a while, I've gotten to this acceptance stage and they've kind of made peace kind of with this whole thing. They're ready to go back to work. But then there's the issue of A, who's going to hire them? B, do they tell their employer? And how do they manage their symptoms and keep it, quote unquote, a secret from their employer? And are they taking all these medications? And what are people, thinking about that? And
so these medications have all these side effects.
Medications can have all these side effects. And if they've gotten off, if they've not been working, they're probably getting some kind of medical benefits through Social Security, disability, or Medicaid, which is paying for their medication. So if they go back to work, they're going to potentially lose mm-hmm. their Social Security, disability.
And I'd imagine these medications are very expensive.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. So it's giving up a huge sense of safety for them. And yet they may want to be productive citizens and feel they can do it. Their disease is managed. So it becomes very tricky for people to figure out what to do. And I think counselors can be extremely helpful in that process of helping them, kind of consider all their options and how they might handle all these very kind of challenging, subtle situations in the employment scene. But I think we're going to be seeing more and more of that. Also, Social Security is coming out and saying, look, we've been supporting you, but now you can work. So we're withdrawing your disability benefits.
So then rightfully these people might be forced.
So they're forced to get back into the workforce. Either that or not be able to take their medication and not have... So it's complicated, and I think we're going to be seeing a lot more issues around that for mental health counselors as well as medical people. All right, so let's see. Finally, the last stage is what we call end-of-life issues, and I think I referred to this earlier, that most people somewhere in the process of counseling around HIV deal with end-of-life issues, even if they're not particularly sick, but they think about this, what this disease means in terms of their death and how they want their death to look. So there's huge issues around that, and one of the things that I have found challenging is when folks move into the stage and really being able to sit with them and have presence with them when it's painful to hear about them talk about their own death. You've developed a relationship with them, and they're doing well, and you've really been going down that road of wellness and well-being, and then all of a sudden they're talking to you about how and when they want to take their own life. Mm-hmm. And it is work that they typically can't do with a whole lot of other people. The people they love who are around them, it's hard for them to sit and talk about these issues. So you may be the only person
that they can trust and they can open up with.
And they could go there with. It doesn't mean necessarily they're going to kill themselves, but they have counseling as a place where they can at least look at that option for themselves.
Mm-hmm. I mean, these might be topics that they can't even explore with their friends and family.
Absolutely.
So that's just in their head. And I imagine a counselor would be somebody who they could actually feel safe enough to talk about these critical issues.
Absolutely. Okay. So it's a huge role that a counselor can play. But it means you have to kind of be in touch with your own issues around mortality and your own comfort around this topic. Mm-hmm. And for me personally, that was a difficult thing for me to do. So kind of looking at that four-stage model, reminding you that, again, it's not linear. So people might be going along in the acceptance stage and then again get sick, or have a crisis, or somebody finds out, or somebody confronts them, mm-hmm. or they fall in love and they have to deal with issues. So they're all the way back in that crisis stage again. And so it is very circular. Mm-hmm. As a counselor, I think one of the things we can get tripped up with is this fix-it mentality, that we're wanting to make people quote-unquote better. And that really is not a conceptual framework that works with working with people with HIV. And instead, the framework I think that's more appropriate is really just following the client where they're at. So if they're into that acceptance stage and they're really working hard and now they're back into crisis, you go back in crisis with them, mm-hmm. and hold the space for them to do the work they need to do with that particular stage. That your job is not to make people feel better or to look better or to act better, but it is to give them a process that will help them wherever they're at, mm-hmm. and just staying with the client.
And I know you've also written a little bit about a strength-based model in terms of working with clients who have HIV,
yes,
or AIDS.
Yes.
Could you briefly describe that?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically helping the client see where their strengths are, noticing where they cope well, and then using that kind of information to help them cope with this particular issue. For example, if they're from a particular multicultural background, you know, looking to that particular culture and what are the strengths of that culture and how people have coped, how they cope individually. Maybe it's a spiritual resource or a church or a temple or something that provides them with a sense of meaning. Helping the people to identify what those things are for them and then to use those in your counseling interventions, instead of really looking at pathology and what's going wrong, because there's so much going wrong oftentimes in people's lives. So I really like kind of just conceptualizing counseling in that way.
Mm-hmm. And that almost goes away again from that fix-it
mentality,
to look at what the client is doing well and to build on those strengths.
And what's unique about you in your particular background, your particular assets, and how can we use those to help you get through the day?
Okay. And you just touched on it briefly here, in terms of multicultural issues. Mm-hmm. Are there any certain issues that are going to impact the treatment of those who have HIV or AIDS?
Well, this disease really does. It has hit people who are from non-mainstream cultures heavily. So kind of associated with all that stigma, for example, in the African-American community, there are certain things that are stigmatized around being gay that might be different than how they look in a different group. Also, the trust. I mean, the medical system in this country is very white. It's very white male overall. And so if you're not from a white male perspective, you may have trouble trusting that the medical system really is to your benefit. And that may be true with counselors too. If you're from a culture that has not felt real safe in this country, due to discrimination, due to stigma, it's going to be really hard to trust that these white male or even female caretakers are going to necessarily be people that are going to be in your best interest. Mm-hmm. So there's some suspicion, I think, of the mainstream culture, and rightfully so. So I think you have to be aware of different cultures and how different cultures look at this disease and what they're doing around the disease as a counselor, and be very mindful of those particular variables.
Well, and I also know that different cultures have different concepts of the way that they look at family and the support
right.
that they get there, different spiritual differences between cultures, and I imagine that would have a lot to play in.
Absolutely.
You know, if you're from, let's say, Hispanic culture, your family is very important to you, so maybe not disclosing this to your family would be not something that would even
exactly.
come up.
Absolutely, good example. And as well, you know, even talking about sexuality in certain cultures is very taboo. So if we have counselors go in there and we start talking about these topics that are extremely uncomfortable for our clients, it's not necessarily going to be a productive intervention.
So it sounds as if you're working with someone who has HIV or AIDS, not only do you have to just deal with, you know, all the issues that are faced on that, if there's somebody from a different culture from you, you have
right.
to also consider all of those issues as on top of
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Okay. And I know
but then there is the issue, the drug abusing culture. I think some people don't look at that, but that is really huge. If you're going to be working with people who are drug abusers, you've got to be able to know some of the dynamics of that particular drug culture.
Okay.
So.
Okay. And I know we spoke earlier about rational suicide. How might that impact counselors who work with clients who have HIV or AIDS? How might the idea of rational suicide impact a counselor?
Well, I think, you know, kind of going back to ethical moral issues, some counselors may not feel that they can have that kind of conversation with someone because that would be, you know, our code of ethics says that we're not to...
We're to protect.
We're to protect. So you as a counselor have to kind of struggle with, can you have that conversation with someone and feel like you're functioning as an ethical mm-hmm. counselor? And I think some people can, and I think some people can't, for various reasons, and not that one's right or wrong, but it is a struggle I think each counselor needs to have mm-hmm. within their own kind of mind and soul. Also, people that are talking about killing themselves, I think one of the important pieces is that are they cognitively and emotionally in a position where they can make those kinds of choices. If I'm really making a choice and that's my right, I have to make sure that I'm functioning to the standard that that would make my decision, you know, an appropriate one. So if I'm very depressed or if I have any cognitive deficits due to mm-hmm. HIV, is this really rational? Or is this, if I'm treated for those particular, if I can be, those particular pathologies, would my choice be different? So that's different from talking to someone who I know is competent. It's basically kind of a competency issue. And because of the vagueness of some of these things, I think you have to be really careful in making sure people are able to make the choice.
Looking more in terms of counselors who might be in training or beginning counselors, what does the research tell us in terms of what are some counselor attitudes and perceptions of people who have HIV or AIDS?
Yeah, I think it is getting better, but there's been some pretty alarming studies done on how even counselors, and we're supposed to be in the mental, you know, in the helping mm-hmm. people field, have stigma against folks with HIV. And I often hear students tell me, well, I really don't need this information because I don't intend to work with people mm-hmm. who are HIV. But my response to that is that whether you want to or not, you probably will, because of the pure numbers. Mm-hmm. And that if you're not directly working with someone who's HIV, you may be working with a mother or a partner or someone, an employer, or someone who has associated with this disease. And so that it's your responsibility as a counselor to have some competency in this mm-hmm. particular area. Mm-hmm. And I do think that more and more counselors are getting on board with learning about, you know, specific interventions and responses to people with this syndrome or this disease.
Okay.
But it's still a long way to go, I think.
Mm-hmm. How prevalent is HIV education and counselor training programs? I know that you teach a course here.
I do. Unfortunately, the numbers even here are going down for that course. I advertised a workshop last summer, and it was canceled for the low attendance. So I don't think counselor ed programs, I think one study was around 14% of counselor education programs had some specific training on HIV. Yeah. My guess is it's probably a little less than that now. I think over the years, different topics become kind of sexy or, you know, popular, and for a while HIV was, and I think it's losing that, partly, I think, because people think it's quote-unquote curable now with these new drugs that people are living. Mm-hmm. So it's not as much of a crisis as it was maybe 10, 15 years ago.
I mean, and you hear
ago.
About it less and less.
And you hear about it less and less. Not exactly sure what all that's about. But I encourage new counselors to do some reading in the area. A lot of it will be generalizable to other people with other diseases. So it's, even if you don't intend to work with HIV again, like we were saying, you might, and then also you can use this information to work with other folks mm-hmm. who are struggling with illness overall.
Okay.
So I think it's a good content area to make yourself aware of and to study.
And this interview is a great opportunity for people to be able to listen to it to get an idea of what are some of the basic issues when working with these clients.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I was wondering, is there anything else that you wanted to add to our discussion today?
I don't think so. I do think I just would want to say that one of the things that I have gotten out of working with people who are challenged by this illness is really an appreciation for the complexity of life, and also this idea of not fixing clients. I remember thinking back on the groups that I used to run, and there would be 25, 30, 40 people in there, that many of whom were dying. And my first feeling at the beginning was, wow, what am I going to say? What possibly could I say?
What could I actually say to these people?
Or do yeah. that's really going to be helpful? So I felt really kind of overwhelmed and insecure and kind of little. But instead, what happened to me, and what they taught me through the years of doing this work, is that they're not looking for me to fix them, but that by my presence, by being there, being in the room with them, and them being able to be together, and us holding a space together, was healing for them. Mm-hmm. And that people aren't looking for me for the quote-unquote answers, but that they need to not be alone and to have the space held where they can do the work is really a pretty amazing thing. So I feel like my life's been changed by doing this work in a really good way. Not to say I ever wish for this disease or I think anything good comes out of this disease. Frankly, it's really horrible. It's a horrible illness. But that I have learned a great deal about what it means to be a counselor from folks who have had this major challenge.
Sounds like
it
was very rewarding work for you.
Yeah, overall.
Personally. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you so much
You're
for talking
welcome.
With us today.
You've just heard an interview with Dr. Paula Britton of John Carroll University about working with clients with HIV/AIDS. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselorAudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4015. counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.